Meditation is the focus of today's episode as we are joined by Sunita Passi, who is the founder of an organization and company called Tridosha. Hopefully I pronounced that right. I will check with her in our conversation. But Sunita is an acclaimed author, Ayurvedic practitioner, teacher, and entrepreneur who is known for her spiritual approach to health, well-being, self-care, and basically helping people to become the best versions of themselves. I'm really looking forward to our episode with Sunita as we explore meditation. Like, where does it come from? Where does it originate from? And what does ancient wisdom say about meditation? But also the science, right? So Sunita, while her practice and her teachings are very much rooted in spirituality and spiritual approach, she has done or is in the process of doing research to support her philosophies and her ideas. I'm really excited to dive into all of that. Before we do so, I use a company called Mind Valley for all of my guided meditations. Now, I know there's a lot of good ones out there, Insight Timer, etc., but I go to Mind Valley. Now, you can save on your Mind Valley membership by clicking the link in the description. They have hundreds of different guided meditations and even guided breathwork sessions that I utilize alongside their programs and their courses and their quests and their webinars and kind of their events and everything else that they do. But I wanted to mention particularly about their meditations, their guided meditations, as this episode is on that. And so if you want to learn more about Mind Valley, save on your membership, then click the link in the description or around this video, this podcast. And without further ado, let's dive into my conversation with Sunita. Sunita, thank you for joining me here on the podcast today. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Good to meet you, Luke. And well done for getting the podcast into the world.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I've been looking forward to this one because obviously we connected on LinkedIn and I was looking through everything that you're doing, obviously your company. I hope I'm going to pronounce it right. So is it Tridosha? Is that your company? Yeah.
Correct. Yes. Said beautifully. Yes.
Excellent. I was looking for everything that you're doing. I have so many questions to ask you today, from consciousness to Ayurveda and a focus on meditation in particular. But before we do that, I would love for you to share a little bit more into who you are, what you do, and actually why you do it.
Well, that's a great question. So I'm Sunita, and I am the founder of Tridosha. So Tridosha is an Ayurvedic training and product company. So, but I've actually got a separate platform for my own teaching. I'm also an author of a book as well called The Doctor Won't See You Now, Staying Healthy While the Medical System is Rebooted. So actually, I started off life as a journalist, and I spent many years writing about business and interviewing managing directors, CEOs, Fortune 500 MDs. And also I wrote about, I was doing specific research on also the IT industry as well. So lots of traveling. It got me, I learned a lot. It was a kind of a crash course, a bit like an MBA, really, learning about business. But through that, I was sort of living in different countries and absorbing that lifestyle, which also, you know, when you're traveling and when you have a career that takes you abroad, there's an element of burning the candle from both ends as well, because you're kind of jumping into these new places, personally just really growing and learning and absorbing all of that. And then also often you'll have quite a demanding career on top of that. And I guess what happened for me was I was holding a lot of stuff from my past, which I hadn't dealt with, and my company sent me to India. And by that point, I'd started to take yoga classes. I'd started to get interested in more sort of maybe sort of spiritual, holistic concepts and ideas. And when I was in India, I started to have Ayurvedic treatments. So Ayurveda, it's a traditional Indian healing system. And it was just really profound. So I resonated really well with the treatments, but I could feel that it wasn't what I'd been taught when I was a kid, when I did biology, it wasn't, it wasn't working on muscles and tissues. It was working on something far beyond that. And with a curious mind, I wanted to learn more. And also it was in India where I came into contact with meditation for the first time as well. I was actually in Hansel Plaza, which is a shopping center in Delhi. Some of your listeners may know of that place, and very popular shopping center and full of amazing saris and artifacts and all sorts of gorgeous things. And right in the corner, there's a little tiny meditation shop. So I wasn't looking at any of these wonderful, colorful things. I walked into this meditation shop and I had a chat with the teacher, who traditionally is known as a Swami, and whatever he said to me in that moment just really resonated. So I guess I came to these tools through, there was a sort of an aspect of me that was seeking, which I can see now, and that's really what put me on my path, I would say. So it was kind of like I was in India, burnt out, but India also really helped me understand more about myself, because I then started this wonderful journey of learning more about the health system that I now teach, Ayurveda.
Amazing. I definitely wanted to talk about meditation and your work kind of specifically around that. Before I do so, you mentioned something there in terms of a curious mind. And I wonder if, no, I wonder how important you feel like that is when we are approaching these things, but actually in from like a more broader perspective as well. It's like in life in general, because a lot of people may have been sent to India or, you know, different country, and maybe discovered these different tools as you referenced, but could have been closed off, right? But you wasn't, you was open to them, and obviously they've changed your life in a profound way. They've definitely changed my life in a profound way as well. And so yeah, I'm curious on how important you feel a curious mind is, and if you feel like we've lost that a bit in society today.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think we've lost it. And the reason for that is, I mean, when I was studying, so if we go back, 20, 24, 25 years ago, before I went into journalism, I've been studying, and then I came back to the place that I was brought up, which is Nottingham. And I studied for a master's in investigative journalism in Nottingham Trent University. And one of the books that we read during that course was a book called The Prying Game. And that was all about how a lot of the information that we receive is manipulated, or it's not basically do some deep diving as to where the information that you're receiving and the content, and just think a little bit more. So I think the seed was sown for me. That always stayed with me, and it helped me. It really changed my worldview of what was going on around. So I've always had this sort of questioning side to me, and I think over the last 20 years in the West, certainly we've been pampered, where everything around us is created in a way where we don't have to think, where we don't have to question, we don't have to redirect our attention beyond anything that's being, put towards us. So in essence, what ends up happening is you actually reduce your thinking capacity. You don't think beyond the information that's being presented to you. So it may be that, let's say you have a health issue or something's come up and you want to gain some knowledge around a path forward. From a mainstream level, it's very easy to just follow what is presented, maybe the majority are, accept that rather than think outside the box and actually have a look at what else is there. So if you look at, for instance, Ayurveda, which is, the system I'm now a qualified practitioner in, it's still very niche in the UK, and yet it's so profound and has so much knowledge that could be helping so many people. The same with Chinese medicine. The same with Yunani, which is another type of system of medicine in Asia. But it's not just health systems. It's also other systems and methods that can support us to understand other ways of working and moving forward as well. So without a questioning mind, you're accepting actually of information that's just it's just one part of actually a much wider puzzle, and you might find a better path for you, whatever that might be. You might identify that actually these specific tools or this system actually suit me better, and I'm going to get better results that way. I also think we have to be careful not to be too cynical about life as well, because otherwise you lose the joy, and that can also lead to ill health and stress and tension, because you're redirecting your attention actually in another area that's causing more angst. So there's a balance to all of this. But yeah, I absolutely believe that, you know, with a questioning mind, it's a process, and it leads you to an opening of perception. There's wider experiences that you're able to have, and you're able to really maneuver your way through finding the information that most resonates with you.
And do you think that can be developed? Like, can people grow that innate ability to be curious, to question things?
You can, but you know, actually, the innate ability is already there, because you're born curious. Think about yourself when you're a child and you're learning, and the capacity to you're learning everything. You're learning to walk, you're learning to talk, you're learning to converse. So the capacity is there. But actually, through life, what happens is things get closed off, and we become more layered, and maybe we become more lethargic, or we just think, you know, actually, it's too much work. It's too much work to work on myself, or shift, or change, there's a sense of peeling the layers off. But having a curious mind, you can also practice this as well, because for anyone who journals, so this is an example of something that you could bring into your life straight away as a tool. If you journal, already you're being asked specific questions when you journal to think about an area of your life from a wider perspective. So actually, in my book, on each chapter, there are questions, and that gets you really thinking about your thoughts on health and well-being. Actually, it examines where you have come up with your thought process, and actually what you identify with. So it starts to unravel all of that. And there are plenty of other journals that enable you to do that as well. And fundamentally, when you start to unravel these things, the key images that you might have had in your mind about this, that, or the other start to loosen. So everything starts to loosen. You start to expand the way that you're looking something. And before you know it, you're bringing a lot more information in. And also what you will find is, once you do start to explore, once you do start to move out of sort of a fixed box, you'll also start to get into more deeper conversations with other individuals who are also doing the same thing. And that also then expands, you know, your mind and your thought processes as well. So it is an opening. I think journaling is a great way to start, actually, if you feel like you've kind of like, you know, you're a bit stuck in the way that you're thinking or absorbing information. But it will lead to more, because it's a process. And you're, you know, before you know it, you're right down the rabbit hole of this, that, the other. But you know, keep it healthy. That would be my, you know, biggest advice is definitely keep it healthy and positive, you know, where it's generating positive energy. So, you know, you should also get, you know, there's a resonance when you're taking in new information as well, that actually, if something is of truth, it has a deep resonance with you. If something doesn't feel right, then probably, you know, trust your intuition. So it's interesting, because in the East, I mean, things are changing there, but in the East, from what I've seen, when I've spent time in the East, and I lived in India for a year, and I spent time in Southeast Asian countries as well, and I worked for a company that had a number of Southeast Asian employees. They tend to be more away from the thinking mind. In the West, we're very in the thinking mind, less in the body. Whereas actually in the East, there's much more of an integration. So that's something that I found when I've spent time in these parts of the world. I think that's something we can absorb as well over here.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned something beforehand about how curiosity is part of our childlike nature, I guess. Is this what is meant by the term, like, your inner child, is to kind of get back to it in a way, or remember, I guess remember would be a good word, remember that part of you that is I guess joyful, right, and fun, and is curious, and is open to things. And I guess, like, I mean, you gave the example there of the tour of journaling, and I'm a huge journaler, if that's even a word. So I like write at least every morning and every evening, right? And that's changed my life.
Yeah.
So I just kind of wanted to kind of, because, you know, this, these sort of terms of like inner child, etc., kind of get thrown around sometimes. But actually, what is kind of meant by them? And I just kind of wondered, in your viewpoint, if kind of like how you describe that, if that is what it means by like that inner part of you.
Yeah, I would agree with exactly how you're describing it. It's that inner part of you. It is the child. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, as grown-ups, we're adults, and we need to be, you know, we're responsible for our lives. You know, but ultimately within us, there's still that essence. There's still that that true nature, but through life's experiences, our worldview may have changed. So we disconnect from that joy, from that bliss, from that childlike nature, because we're absorbed by you know, all the people, the places, the experiences, everything else that becomes layered as we move into adulthood. And how I look at it, when people say, you know, childlike nature or connecting with your inner child, from my perspective, and there's different perspectives, you know, of how people describe this, but it is that true place of you where you're in your fullness. It's from the Ayurvedic perspective, we may say that's your prakriti, your genetic constitution. It's you know, it's your innate nature. So it's your innate nature, and what tends to happen is through life, then we have a manufactured nature, which actually isn't the true essence of who we are. It's more a survival mechanism, you know. And we've got, you know, if you go into psychology, then we've got also layers of the different selves. You know, the one that we show to people, the one that we keep private, you know, the one that we take to work. And but ultimately the child within is your true nature. That's who you are. And it's fundamental to also your happiness, because if you're living a life that's completely not aligned with that true essence, then how can you be joyful? How can you be happy? Because actually that beautiful soul and spirit within is having a little bit of a an angst, you know, because there's a misalignment going on from actually what you are within to actually what you're showing the world. And I do think, you know, again, you know, we are living in this world where we're inundated with social media. We've got so many different platforms. We've got this going on, that going on, influencers. We've got all of this coming onto our sort of right in front of us, that it's difficult to illuminate that truth, because, you know, you've got to sort of get through so many layers to really, you know, to really figure out what, you know, what actually am I looking at? Is this person trying to sell to me, or is this person trying to educate me, or is this, should I be listening to this? Is this valuable? There's this whole funky process that kind of has to go on, you know, in these days. But if we were all showing up in our authentic self, in our true self, and illuminating that side of us, we wouldn't have that. Actually, there would be a sense of camaraderie and joy and a sense of fulfillment, because we're all being our authentic selves. So I guess that's another word I've just added in there. But yeah, absolutely, your true innate nature. Definitely.
One practice that has helped me, and I'm sure has helped countless others to, I like the word remember, like remember who I truly am, that inner nature, etc., as we're talking about, is the practice of meditation. I know this is a huge kind of part of your work as well. I'm curious on the benefits from a personal level and how it can help and advance the quality of our lives to what it means on a larger scale as well, or like how it helps, I guess, like the masses, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, my, you know, how I got connected to meditation was I didn't even know I was looking for it. And, you know, like I said, as we started this, our chat, I walked into this meditation shop in Delhi. And I was so blown away by what the teacher said to me that the next retreat was coming up the following week, or, you know, and it was an intense 3-day full on retreat. I'd never been to a retreat before. I didn't even have a meditation practice. And I decided to go, decided to jump on. And during these 3 days, it was really phenomenal what I experienced. And it was a series of different exercises. So this particular retreat, it was just outside, an hour outside of Delhi. So we're in a really beautiful part of India, and you know, you're surrounded by nature, very, very simple place. And that was a real contrast to how I was living my life, because actually that time when I was traveling with my work, you know, I'd always be in a luxury hotel. In the developing countries, we'd have a driver. We needed a driver to get to the appointment. So here I am, having an opposite reality. And it was a bit of a deep dive. I'm not sure whether I would recommend doing it this way, but this is how I got connected to it on a very deep level. And it was a combination of different tools. So we had some kind of like movement before we went into the different meditations. Some of them were guided, some of them were breathing. There was a real stillness to it. And I felt very emotional, and I was teary through the process. And I felt a connection with myself that I feel had been missing, you know. And I felt an energy, a life force, an experience through myself, through my body, that helped me get, I think, you know, connected with aspects of myself that I believe I blocked. So that was a really powerful, you know, beginning. And then I've gone on to have a practice, and then qualify as a meditation teacher, and have developed our own system now that we now through Tridosha teach therapists. And so on a personal level, this is, you know, when you have a meditation practice, you go beyond your ego. So everything that we're putting out there in the world, in this beautiful, lovely, but ultimately so many masks. And lots of, you know, sort of all these different ways of showing up parts of you. But when you, when you have a meditation practice, there's a deep sense of healing that will start to happen. So sometimes people say to me, they say, oh, I'm cool, I don't need any healing. You know, everybody's got something. We've all had experiences in life. And so there's always, you know, there's aspects of ourselves that we can have that we may have pushed down and buried, but ultimately when we can bring light energy into those spaces, we can really heal something that's been buried. So on a personal level, there's very deep healing that takes place. From a Western perspective, we tend to talk more about the stress and anxiety and the tension, which is all part of it as well. But it's really so much more than that. And as we heal ourselves, as we become less attached to our ego as well, this sends ripple effects out. So we're showing up more authentically. We're showing up with a more loving, compassionate nature. We're having more empathy for others. We're more socially aware. We're more able to feel guided and know what's, you know, the right path, what's good for us. And if you think about that as dimensions, you know, the more we can send that energy out, you know, the greater good it is for everyone. And it was actually, I'm currently doing research for my next book, which is very much looking at energy and frequency and vibrations. And so I've just been doing some research on the different stages of consciousness, which I think really link beautifully with meditation. And there's an author, a kind of philosopher, you probably know him, Luke, called Ken Wilber, and he talked about the four different stages of consciousness. So he talks about 1% of the self, where, you know, they're only connected with themselves and nobody else. Then you've got ethnocentric, which is about 70%, which is the mass, where, you know, they like it if you feel familiar, or you know, it's you know, that they yeah, you know, there's a sense of familiarity, camaraderie, you know, at that level. He says that about 26% that are world centric, and that's lovely. That's where we feel connected to each other. There's a sense of oneness there. And then there's 2% which are cosmocentric, which are really those who are very much focused on how do we put energy behind deeply healing humanity. And they're very concerned also from an authentic perspective with the future, with the plant, with the plants, animals, trees, nature. But it's not greenwashing. You know, it's coming from a place of understanding that you know, the seeds that we sow now are impacting you know, our world and our future. So I'm thinking, and I know other teachers have talked about it as well. Another mentor of mine, he recently sent me an ebook which was actually written by somebody who works with corporates. And in this ebook, they're talking about sort of similar concepts to what Ken Wilber is talking about, and but from a corporate perspective. And there's a diagnostic tool in it which is all about immunity to change, and I think that's where it comes from, really. You know, it's this one aspect that we get drawn to certain tools and techniques in our lives should we feel blocked, should we feel we need to, you know, experience more. Less stress, less tension, more joy. You know, what are those tools? But also, you know, we can get attracted when we also think that we want to experience something's not working. You know, maybe we feel actually this is I'm not showing up in my best way, or I'm having too many toxic conversations, or something's just not right. And that also can be a time, I believe, when people start to look at tools like meditation and it really starts to open them up. But I think for the most part in the West, it starts with stress. Mm. I really do.
Yeah, yeah, it seems to be the society like we live in, unfortunately. But in terms of if you mentioned that your research, I'm fascinated to kind of touch on this. So from the research that you've been doing, kind of two questions. So have you, or maybe your own insights and obviously your experiences of going to India and living there, etc., what have you found on like the origin of meditation, and what do you think, like, at its core, what is, like, what are we talking about here?
Yeah, wow, that's, yeah, what are we talking about? It's huge. But let's backtrack. So origins, if you so the origins so from an Indian perspective, the origins have come through the Vedas, which is the traditional system of knowledge. And what we can see there is that the sages, the saints, understood the benefits of meditation, also yoga, yogic breathing, these sorts of tools that progressed individuals in their development for higher states of consciousness. So, you know, we're at that sort of level when you look at the roots of mindfulness, or meditation. Mindfulness is, you know, is within the system of meditation. So, you know, and that's that, you know, so that's a huge concept. Also, you know, meditation was being practiced in other countries as well. So I'm not saying it was solely aligned to India. But you know, what that perspective was very much about experiencing unity and bliss. It wasn't about stress reduction. It was about identifying with our higher selves and actually being able to transcend the material plane and connect with the spiritual plane. And if you go to India, you'll see there's temples everywhere, because people have a practice and they're enjoying that experience. Still, I sometimes go to the Hindu temple with my mum in where the town I live in, and it is a moment of bliss. You know, you can sit there for 30 minutes, you know, with other people who are there, and they, you know, they're either coming together with a meditation or some chanting, or you know, it could be a visualization, but generally being guided by a teacher, and everybody collectively comes together in this beautiful, loving circle. And it's very profound, and that energy carries on. You feel so much lighter, you feel blissful, you know, you feel, you know, some people may feel they're having, you know, feeling more transcendent, euphoric. There's so many different experiences. But this would have been the normal state. You know, this was not something you had to go seeking or chasing. This is what we do. Of course, they had other problems because they didn't know, you know, it could be a big wild bear coming for them around the corner, or getting food wasn't as easy as it is for us now, because we can just pop to the shops. So there were other issues, but from this perspective of meditation, it was widely understood and recognized the huge benefits that it had in the expansion of consciousness. So that's really where it started. And then, the West, because we don't live or practice in that way. In the East, they live and practice in that way. Though, like I say, I know things are changing now, because even when, you know, I'm talking to people in India, I can see how things are changing. But it was in the West, we didn't connect with those tools. So, you know, we don't go to school, or, you know, we don't have conversations about consciousness, spirituality, self-development, evolution. That's not part of our normal vocabulary. It's something that we as adults go seeking, you know, once we're living our own worlds, and maybe there's an experience that maybe starts to put you on that path. But then also the other thing is in the West, we, you know, we're living in this in data. I need data. I need science. So we're also living at times where, you know, the mass aren't accepting of a lot of this information unless it's backed by, you know, this scientific experiment and this data. And that's all great, because actually that's really helping me formulate, you know, my next book. And we're making sure there's a lot of data in there. But ultimately it was for the expansion of consciousness. It was to redirect intention and attention, you know, towards the feeling of unity and bliss, and how powerful that can be as well, you know, collectively when people come together. So, you know, if you look at some of the earliest images of Ayurveda and how Ayurveda, the information was passed down to others, you'll see that actually there's beautiful pictures of the sages sitting on the mountains in Rishikesh, which is a mountainous area in North India. And they're all sitting together and they're meditating. And, you know, some of the stories say that actually the information of Ayurveda was downloaded to the sages, you know, as they sat in meditation. But what I feel, you know, was happening there was that actually this information is all within us. It's our internal wisdom. And you know, again, there's a sense of blockage. So you know, we need to have wider conscious states in order to tap in to that wisdom. And ultimately, when we do, it's phenomenal. The information that is there. And then that got passed down, to other people. So it's really powerful stuff. But it's good in the West that we are having more of these conversations now, and we're having that, I think our just identifying and exploring these tools and techniques is leading to wider states of consciousness and greater presence in people as well. And there's so much more possibility when we all start to, start to come from that perspective. So it's exciting. And I think those figures that Ken came up with, Ken Wilber, I do believe they're shifting and changing. I believe there is that 70% mass is becoming less, and there's more moving into the higher, into those higher states as well. So, let's see.
I would definitely link, I'm familiar with Ken Wilber, so I'd link his work down below for viewers and listeners who want to kind of check that out. But in terms of the data that you're using to support, obviously, your content and your work in your new book, what have you found from research? Like, what data have you found that you can share, obviously, here? About whether it's about meditation or some of the more of the ancient practices that actually have obviously they have a benefit, but like now modern science is like confirming that, I guess, for us here in the West who need those numbers.
Yeah, good point. So I'll start off with one piece of data that's readily available and I think is widely accepted as a piece of data that various systems within meditation is often supported to help market that. So in the 60s, it was a crazy time in the West, I think we'll all agree. And there was the Beatles were huge and massive and going all over the world, and they were a global sensation, and then women were gaining more freedom. And then there was this wonderful teacher called Maharishi, who was an Indian meditation teacher, spiritual teacher. And his teacher had said to him, he said, you know, Maharishi, you need to go to the West now and teach the Westerners meditation. It's time. So he said, OK, packed his bag, came over to the West, and he settled in Wales, and he was there for years. And he was doing what he thought his, teachers had asked of him. So he was running classes for the local people in Wales, and he was, dressed traditionally. He was this traditional Indian teacher. But his work was starting to get widely spread and widely known. And, people were really experiencing the benefits, and people could see how committed he was. He was living a life of service. And that was very different to, the expectation of how we live our lives and what our life is about. Then he was, through an introduction, he was introduced to the Beatles, and they said, it said that they were looking for something, a change at that point, because they'd had so much success and, this notoriety with their work at that point, that I guess they were looking for bliss. I guess they were looking for a connection with them, themselves again. Anyway, they were introduced to Maharishi, and they invited him to go on tour with them and teach them meditation. So he actually, there's a cave in Rishikesh, which is the cave where he taught the Beatles to meditate. And he taught them a particular technique called transcendental meditation. So transcendental meditation is the repetition of a sound. It's based on your birth date and the presence of the moon at that time. So we all have a unique mantra. We all have our unique sound. That if we repeat that and we meditate on that vibration, it's very powerful for us individually. Beautiful technique. It's a really beautiful technique. And he was popularizing that technique because he also knew that in the West, if he focused on more complex techniques, it probably wouldn't be picked up. So hence he said, okay, this is the technique I'm really going to spread. Now transcendental meditation became so popular. Everybody wanted to train in it. Everybody wanted their unique sound. And everybody wanted to know how to do it. So that continued. And then there was an experiment because by this point, I think we were probably, I don't know if I'm getting my figures 100% right, but I think we were a good 10 years in by this point. And there was an experiment to have a look at how people within a town, if the mass were meditating, how crime would drop. So this was a really, really, really powerful example of the power of collective meditation. So the results were phenomenal. And so that data is widely available. I mean, I can even have a look, you know, for the link for you, Luke, but it's there. If you have a look at, you know, I can send you some links. But it's so that I think is a really powerful piece of data because it's something that everybody can get their heads around. And it follows on from a story that was just experienced by so many. I mean, when I first started teaching Ayurvedic bodywork, which was 18 years ago, I had students in my classes who were elder to me, and they'd been around when transcendental meditation was getting very popular. One of them had actually met the Maharishi and trained with the Maharishi. And when you speak to these individuals, they really honestly talk about how deeply thankful they are for having learned the technique, because as life went on, all sorts of challenges came up, you know, divorces, death, grief. And they were able to pull on this tool and technique to support themselves through it. So I think that's the, you know, that's a really powerful piece of, you know, data, an experiment that was taken place. The modern data, there's some really good, you know, there's really good experiments that are taking place. There was another 100 students in India that I'll probably you know, look more deeply at this example as well, that were practicing yogic breathing. And through that experience, they were able to see a drop in blood pressure. Various health conditions were checked, diabetes, stress and anxiety. So various health conditions were able to match to those individuals that actually took part in that experiment, and they could see the shifts that had taken place. There's a lot more examples also from a Western perspective as well. They tend to be smaller. It tends to be smaller groups of tests, but again, you know, giving profound results. You know, looking at meditation, you know, now we've got the apps, which we didn't have 10, 15, 20 years ago. And, you know, one of the ones that's been really successful is Headspace. And actually Headspace did put together an ebook on science data within meditation to show people, you know, a whole bunch of experiments that have taken place. So that's really useful to give to your viewers as well. And there's more as well. You know, there's also specific, if you look at, you know, if you look at the breathwork techniques, the pranayama, you can see that there's so much more science now behind the breathwork techniques. And also we've got new systems being evolved as well. So we've got, who's the wonderful breathwork teacher? Will, he did a BBC documentary recently. I will forget his name, but he's become, you know, he seems to, you know, he's very much from a very powerful story himself. Is now building a platform to really educate people about the power of breathwork. And I think he taps on, you know, various different traditions in order to share those techniques as well. So science has definitely caught up. I don't think there's anyone out there who could say, you know, well, prove it to me, because there's so many incredible experiments and there's really powerful data that's out there now to really show you the benefits.
Yeah, I'll research and kind of link all this down below for people. You mentioned breathwork there, and I actually wrote this down in this question. So in my naivete, I guess, when I kind of first got all into this, I kind of seen meditations and breathwork as kind of two different practices. I still kind of see that, but then obviously they can also be integrated into one practice as well. What, like, from your experience and stuff, is there a difference between the two? Like, how can we, like, I guess, bring them into one practice? Is that like the best approach for the best results, or, you know, does meditation have its own time and place? Does breathwork have its own time and place? And would love to explore that in the time we have.
Yeah, I love that question. So, because again, it's something else, you know, that's I'm really looking deeply at the moment as well. So, in my opinion, and having been teaching for 18 years now, I see them as two separate tools. So breathwork, from the Ayurvedic perspective, we've got a system called pranayama. So prana is life force, yama is the extension of that life force, and that's really working with the breathwork tools. So anyone who goes to yoga will most likely practice some of the tools, techniques within that class. Sometimes it's the beginning, sometimes it's at the end. But it's a wonderful way to really open up the body, open up all of the energy centers, and let the prana, the life force, really flow through all of those energy centers. And that's where you get that sense of deep relaxation at the end and just feeling so at one and at peace and, you know, that beautiful, really beautiful light feeling. Guided meditation is the separation of thoughts and feelings so that you become fully aware. So here we are using different tools. You know, the system of meditation is profound. So mindfulness is a method within meditation. And this is what's very popular in the West, where a mindfulness practice is where you may be mindful of your breathing. So that is a mindfulness practice. You may be mindful of the way that you're walking and actually the nature that you're taking in. You may be mindful of staring at a light and the energy that gives you, and actually what profound relaxation that gives you. You know, this within meditation, we also have guided meditations where you can be taken on a journey, and there's a structure to that journey. So generally speaking, there's an awakening process through that journey, which is connecting you to a source within nature. It's a process to bring more awareness into the connection between the body and the mind. So this process leads you to that greater sense of awareness. I feel with meditation, it's more a sense of that you can almost, you're able to, you know, visualize yourself looking down on yourself in the sense of in full awareness. So you're not embroiled in the angst and the tension and the toxicity and that way you can receive just greater awareness, greater guidance. It helps you with your decision-making process. It assists you in experiencing a deeper sense of who you are. So, yeah, to answer your question, I would say they are two different tools. And one of the things, you know, that I'm really excited about, so, you know, the tools that I teach therapists are an integration of the Ayurvedic bodywork, which is energy-based breathwork and guided meditation. And what I've seen collectively through all of our data is that the integration of the tools give you the greater results, you know, in the sense of really leading to an opening of perception. So, you know, insights, thoughts, feelings that come in, having greater awareness expanding the awareness of what that is and how it collectively supports you. And it may not be, you know, for somebody to have a practice like that, that takes some time and some effort and also learning the tools and how also to gauge the success for you. It may be for some, they've got 10 minutes in the morning. So actually engaging in 10 minutes of breath work is really powerful, is beautiful, 10 minutes of, you know, visualization or even self-massage. But actually, if you can integrate the three, it's really powerful. It's you're taking your that sense of awareness really deep within. So there's a sense of switching the senses off and going into that space. So yeah, integration is great. And that's why I was going to say, if you look at how yoga has evolved over the centuries, you'll see that yoga is it's asanas, it's postures, it's again opening up the body so energy can flow freely through, and how it's evolved is it's an integration generally of the postures with the breath work, because again over time it's been seen just how powerful that is.
Amazing. You mentioned there something I wanted to touch on in terms of, is it from your perspective, you know, if people have 10 minutes in the morning, is it good to or the best practices to just like get into the habit of practicing these techniques, or is there something, or is there like from everything that you've kind of researched and stuff, an optimal kind of time, time of day, etc., or does these little things, are they like the 1%, you know, and actually practicing is the main thing?
I would say the latter. Practicing is the main thing. Having a practice, whatever that looks like, even if that's 5 minutes, you know, the more regularly you do something, the more it becomes a habit. So that's another thing, again, you can, you know, when you look at habits and how long it takes to learn a new habit. So, you know, some data says 21 days, some says 40. I actually believe it's 66. I think it takes at least that amount to really bring in a new habit. So the more regularly you're practicing, the more it's going to become a natural habit, like brushing your teeth. Now, traditionally, there are cycles because you've got the circadian rhythm and you have and the way nature works around you. So in a perfect life, if you were, you know, living on a hill somewhere lovely, then there are optimum times to practice. In Ayurveda, we've actually got a daily practice called Dinacharya, which really states the times that you should do things in a day. Now, that's wonderful in a perfect world, but ultimately that's not how we're living our lives in the West or the East, or, you know, really anywhere in the world now. So it's better to bring in something that, you know, you can easily, you know, you can bring into your life, and it's not going to be it's not going to be too difficult for you. It's not, doesn't feel like a mountain to climb. It should also feel joyful. You know, I've seen working with clients, if something feels hard work, they give up. You know, it's very difficult to continue something if you're, now I'm not saying that you're necessarily getting the results straight away, but if it really feels like hard work, it's less likely you're going to make it, you know, and even get to the point where you see the transformation, where you start to feel the results. So having it as a regular habit is the most important thing, because also it's just the day to day shifts and change that actually bring in the transformation. It's not something that just happens overnight. You know, I have spent time in India when I've been around certain individuals who really wanted to kind of switch on, you know, just like switch on the transformation, and it's quite something else to see when you're around that. But that ain't how it works, you know. It's just incremental changes, and you'll start to see your energy shift. You'll start to see, you know, this all ties in very much with vibrations and frequency. You'll start to feel that you feel you just feel better. You know, you don't feel so angsty. You know, you might notice that the little cat that keeps walking on your drive that you've never noticed before, you start to notice the cat and you want to leave out a little plate of milk. But you have to check with the owner, make sure that's okay. But you're just, behavior just slowly starts to shift and change. And it's an inner knowing, you know, it's something that's happening from the inside out. And you feel very anchored as you go through the process as well. If you don't feel anchored, then, you know, I would say you might even be trying too hard, because it shouldn't be something that, a gentle, you know, feeling of more connection, of feeling less blocked, having more energy, vitality, feeling generally grateful. So it's moving much more into that heart space where you're operating at a higher state of consciousness, but you're not, it's not something you've had to work for. It's just natural internal shifts that are happening because you've got a lovely practice and it's starting to benefit you. So it's a sense of self-care, very, very deep sense of self-care.
Yeah, like definitely. I think one thing that I've recently done is I've slightly changed the my rhythmic breathing, and yeah, I've kind of noticed like how over time that's led to like more calmness, etc., etc., you know, just by changing like one thing even within the practice. And that's what it is, right? It's a practice, so we need to practice the practice, right? And you know, there is no, in my opinion, you know, there is no, I think that's one of the challenges that people face, is like they're doing it wrong, right? Or they only have 5 minutes, or they only have 10 minutes. What is your advice for people who have these challenges with meditation, and maybe that's why they don't practice? You know, I've got a lot of family and friends who are like, you know, I don't need that, right? And I think actually maybe they're mindful of doing it wrong or practicing it wrong, or they just don't feel like they need it. Well, I feel like personally we all require some level of mindfulness or meditation practice, you know, and that can look different for everyone. So yeah, in the time we have to wrap up, I just want to touch on the common challenges that you kind of see, and what would your advice be to these people?
Yeah, common challenges, exactly what you've said. So time is number one. People will say they'll start a practice and then they say, oh, I haven't got time. So that's number one. And the other one is I can't do it. So they just feel like, you know, the monkey mind is it doesn't matter how much I practice, all the noise is there, the voices are still there, and I'm not able to switch off. So then they think they're doing it wrong. So they're the two. So time, that's just an excuse, because actually I would say to anyone, once you have a practice, you'll see you'll have more energy, and you'll get back more time because you'll feel more energized. You know, and that's something that you really have to understand, that actually as you go into meditation, as you open up, you know, the energy centers, as you unblock all the stuff that no longer serves you, ultimately it's feeding you, it's rejuvenating you, it's nurturing you. So you will gain time. That's really important. And then for those that feel they just can't do it, it's not a competition. It's just you know, if you're in a practice and thoughts and feelings, they're still coming, let them. But over time, what you'll see is you'll generally start to be less attached to the noise that may still be there. And that's so many people, Luke. You know, so many people feel like that. They just feel it doesn't matter how much I try and practice. I've downloaded the app. I've done this. I've done that. I've bought the CD. I've read the book. I just can't switch off. It may take months, it may take longer than that, but the more you commit to it in the long run, that's the only way you can expect to experience the benefits. Thoughts and feelings will always come. You know, we've got so many things going on every single day. We're having so many experiences. We've got thousands of cells in our body, and each one carries a membrane, and, you know, and it's carrying all the experiences that we're having every single day, all the conversations that we're having, all the energy that we're putting out, all the energy we're putting in. So it's not, you know, having a meditation practice, it's not about blocking all of that out and being in Zen, but it's about being mindful over time. It's about non-attachment, really, that you're able to have that 5 minutes, have that 10 minutes, and it allows you to just have a more conscious state that's generally more fully aware, so that you're less reactive to, you know, this, that, and the other, and everything else that's going on. So giving up is not the answer. You know, I would say just integrate it in the same way that you brush your teeth. I spend time in the morning. I can't start my day without it, because it just sets me up for the day, and I feel grounded, and I feel, you know, I feel grateful for another day. I feel it's just puts me in a good mindset. And I think if you can look at it from that perspective, that actually it's a practice that you're integrating in that's of benefit. It doesn't matter if thoughts, feelings, sensations are still there. You know, you're enabling, you're giving yourself that time, which is precious, because once the day starts, it gets super busy anyway. And of course, there's going to be a million and one things that are preying on your time. But this is something that you're giving to yourself. You're giving yourself something really beautiful that you will absolutely benefit from. It's a very, very powerful experience. So they're the two main areas that I think people need to just understand, that, you know, you'll gain time, you won't lose it. And don't stress if you don't think you're doing it right or can't do it. Or also, the other thing with that is, it may be that you want to try a different practice, exactly what you said, Luke, that you're finding that certain practices now are benefiting you more. Now that's actually part of Ayurvedic philosophy, because we all have our own unique constitution. So actually, it may be that your constitution resonates more deeply with certain techniques than my constitution. You know, maybe it's other techniques that are suitable to me. So that's also worth you know, exploring. And if one type of practice doesn't suit you, so let's say transcendental meditation, and actually it does nothing for you, then there's so many other practices that you can try as well. You know, some people that I work with, they just really love the guided meditations. They just say, I prefer to hear the voice. You know, I like to be guided. It gives me a sense of calm, and that's something that works for them. So it's also finding the right tools. Finding the right tools is really important as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think I would just echo that and just kind of say that, as I mentioned beforehand, like, it's a practice, right? So, you know, it's not about, there is, from my perspective, you know, there isn't perfect, right? You know, it's just about being present, you know, and like having the experience. I know we spoke about your book briefly at the beginning, but The Doctor Won't See You Now is your book. Where can people buy this book, find it, and what can we expect? Like, what are the main takeaways that you help people with in the book?
So the tagline is that it's called The Doctor Won't See You Now, Staying Healthy While the Medical System is Rebooted. So I published it during lockdown. I wanted to really support people with tools and techniques, you know, because it was such a stressful time for a lot of people. The book itself actually takes you through, it's an overview of Ayurveda, which is the system that I'm a practitioner in. But the takeaways are really in it. You'll be able to self-diagnose your own Ayurvedic body type, because there's a chart in there. It's actually at the back, not at the front, which is a different way of doing it. But that's because I wanted the reader to really get into the content first before they went to the back and went, oh, what dosha am I? What body type am I? So it's done in that way. But at the back, there is a consultation process, and there's a table which then actually will top level will show you which techniques are more suitable for you. There's also a chapter on nutrition. So if you're looking to have more of a clean diet, you want to have a look at certain ingredients or spices that may be more suitable for your constitution, then I think that chapter's really solid as well. And there is a chapter on the things that we've been talking about. So it's actually broken down into, I think it's 12 chapters, but each chapter covers a different different tools within the Ayurvedic system. And it's a completely holistic system. So, you know, it's going back to this idea of integration, that you've got this whole 360 degree approach. And but it's really finding, you know, find the tools that really work for you. There's lots of nice content in there as well. And it's an overview. So anyone can pick the book up and gain knowledge from it. And it's available on Amazon. Amazon, all online platforms. There's some nice illustrations in there as well for some yoga postures. So if any of your audience like yoga, then there's some lovely illustrations in there.
And forgive me if I'm wrong, but I might have seen your direct website or Tridosha's website, also the test or the quiz for the constitution as well. Is that also available on your website?
It is, yep. So if you go to the Tridosha website, that's tri-dosha.co.uk, you can do the consultation process on there. Now, it's a top level. So one thing I will say, the online quizzes are brilliant to give you top level. But obviously, like anything, if you have got a health concern, then I definitely recommend speaking to a practitioner or doing a bit more of a deep dive. Mm. And depending on where you are in the UK, we've got the therapists that we've trained are also listed on the Tridosha website. So you can go to the tab at the top where it says therapists, and then you can have a look at the map and see who's local. But you'll get a lot of information, you know, like I say, top level from the online quiz.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, Sunita, thank you so much for your time today. I've been diving into everything Ayurveda, and I've been practicing meditation for a few years now, but I've learned so much also here today with yourself. So I appreciate your time, and I'm sure our listeners have as well. For everyone listening, I would highly recommend checking out Sunita's website. I will link everything down below. All of the mentions in this episode I'll also link below as well. And Sunita, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thank you.